Welcome to the Everyday Innovator Podcast for product managers, developers, and innovators. Your host is Chad McAllister, who gives you innovation training your customers will love you for. Get ready to take your career to the next level, for the doctor is in.
Hi, this is Chad. Today I have the pleasure of being with Jeff Peters, and he is one of the nicest and most professional people involved in product management you could ever meet. He is the product development manager for Compassion International, and we met a few years ago when he was working on a project called Water of Life that I'm anxious to hear more about. Yes, one of the things I like so much about talking about, Jeff, is I don't know too many people that's been involved in a nonprofit organization that's really had an integral role in helping them with product innovation. And I'm hoping that you're able to have some influence with other nonprofits too, because we need more product management discipline in those organizations for sure. So thanks for spending time today talking about innovation.
Yeah, thanks for talking with me. Looking forward to talking.
Very good. So your background, how did you end up in product management in the first place?
Yeah, I think as with all oftentimes, your career path ends up being this thing. You look in the rearview mirror and you go, okay, I guess it sort of makes sense in hindsight. I can see where maybe God was leading that path, but I couldn't tell you, you know, I couldn't have predicted that from the future, you know, from looking at it into the future from the very start. My undergraduate degree was in public relations, and I always had a very big passion for helping people to connect, whether it's with the story, with an idea. And so public relations was the thing that really kind of, that's where I really nurtured that out of the gate. Later on, and I began my career really in the public relations industry, and then quickly moved over into the world of demography and really working specifically with churches and nonprofits, helping them to understand the demographics of their community. And then how do I package new offerings for my community based on me now understanding that, for example, there's 65% of the community around your local church is single moms. Maybe packaging some kind of a childcare solution alongside all the other programs you offer is a wise idea and that kind of thing. So
you were doing market segmentation research and figuring out what the market segment should be.
Yeah, that's exactly right.
And then figuring out what needs they have and how you can provide a solution.
Absolutely right. And it ultimately, now as I've transitioned, you know, here 10 years later into my current role here at Compassion International, I really kind of look to some of those early days as forming the idea, which would ultimately become product development. I can look in hindsight and see the different skill sets that I picked up along the way that all kind of lead toward the same passion, which is how do we get people to embrace, in our case, in the nonprofit world and in this Christian nonprofit world, how do we get people to listen to a new opportunity to engage and make a difference in the world as Christ would have called them to do, and packaging those opportunities in a way that allows them to see the difference that they really can make. Mm-hmm. So it's really a hodgepodge of all those skills and passions from quite a while now.
And they've come together. It sounds like the focus there for you have been developing product, some service, something of value that really makes a difference to people in their lives. So some of us as innovators, we just love creating something new. Other of us are really drawn to the value that the change that that makes to someone.
Yeah, and I think that's been one of the tougher things as I really dove in and began to study the product development discipline, and I got my NPDP certification through PDMA and began having conversations with other product developers. It really did strike a chord for me that one of the distinctive differences that, at least in the world that we have, in the world where I play in, is sort of this nonprofit sector, is our goal really genuinely is to bridge a value curve on both ends of the spectrum. So you're going to give money or make a donation or support a product or a need for a child living in developing world poverty, you know, half a world away, that's going to provide safe water or a mosquito net or HIV medication or help to, you know, keep them safe and out of a child trafficking situation. And we build products to help you do all of those things, but it's not just about what it does for that child. It's also about how the donor or the person making the donation or initiating the support, what this product does in their life, helping them to understand who they have been scripted to be. The power that they have as an individual to make a difference in someone else's life and to hopefully plant the type of seeds which makes them want to go out and do that more often, either through compassion or through any other organization, their local church or another nonprofit. Just something that says, you know, I'm part of this larger kingdom of God out here in the world, and I want to do more. And so building a product that really affects a massive change in the life of both the child and the person initiating the support, the supporter, has been a challenge that's not been, I guess, not been something that I guess a lot of other product developers that I've spoken with deal with. Most of the time, as I talk with folks in the CPG world, it's, I want to make something that is going to be a value. They're going to pick it off the shelf. They're going to say, I'm choosing this product over that product, and I'm going to purchase it, and I'm going to take it and make it my own, and I'll consume it, and then I'll go back to the store and buy another one. And we're kind of a different animal here.
Right. So you talk about those two ends of the spectrum of your value chain is the sponsor providing the funds for the projects, and then the actual end customer is the child who is impoverished and you're providing care for.
That's right.
Okay. So big picture, compassion as a biblical mission of providing for impoverished children across the world. And I think you've been in 29 countries now doing this work.
Yeah, compassion. We have 26 program countries and 11 fundraising countries. So okay. We're everywhere.
Yeah. Just about. So give us the history a little bit of product management inside this nonprofit. How did this come about? Because compassion, for those who know it, has been around for decades, providing sponsorship for impoverished kids to help educate them, feed them, clothe them, and provide for their health. Now you're doing some new products. How did that come about?
So compassion, yeah, like you said, we've been around, we just celebrated our 60th anniversary a couple years ago. So we've been around and been growing for over 60 years now. We started very small in just really doing stuff post-Korean War. And our programs at that point really were dedicated around just one person helping one child. And that's still our core model. But as we've grown over the years, we now work directly in that one-on-one, that same one-to-one model with 1.5 million kids across those 26 countries where we do programs. And as with any organization, as you expand, as you grow, for us, what we've discovered is we go into more rural areas. We discover kids with even greater need. We discover kids with needs that we, in some cases, haven't had a solution for in the past. Or on the flip side, we've discovered in some cases there's been issues that we've been fighting for a while, such as unsafe water, that up until more recently, there hasn't been technology available or opportunity available to provide safe water, as an example, into a child's home. Mm-hmm. Previously, if you wanted to do that in a child's home, you do a central well, and then you've got to do plumbing, basically. And when you're talking, you know, over a million kids around the globe, that gets pretty pricey pretty quick. Mm-hmm. And that's not something that's sustainable, especially when safe water is simply just one building block to enable the child to actually have a great education, to be able to have health and go to school, to be able to have health and go to church, to actually grow and thrive as the child God created them to be. Water is just one of those building blocks. So it's a critical piece, but something that was cost prohibitive before some more recent technologies. And so sometimes we see a brand new need arise. Sometimes we see a brand new technology arise. And ultimately, either of those two things can create the catalyst for a new product for us.
Mm-hmm. Okay. So it's really being in the field, seeing what the needs are, and trying to bring a solution to that. What was Compassion's experience with developing new products? How did you come about creating a process for that?
Yeah, that's a good question. When you're in an organization like Compassion International, we have right now, I think our numbers are right at about 3,500 staff globally. There's 1,000 just here out of this office here in our headquarters in Colorado Springs.
And I should mention for the listeners, we're actually doing this interview live at your headquarters in Colorado Springs.
So that's right. Yeah.
Get to meet you.
Right here in the office. And so when you're in an organization like this full of people who are driven by deep, deep spiritual, faith-based motivations for why we do what we do. And I think in any organization, when you have a really healthy staff environment, good staff rapport, good staff morale, you end up with almost no shortage of ideas. I got a new idea. What if we helped kids do this? What if we worked on this issue over here? So we literally have, I mean, just no shortage of ideas, thousands at a time. And as we began to see more and more of the need for us to expand and offer some of these ancillary products to raise funds and to raise and to enable capacity in some of these new areas where we need to work, we started seeing no shortage of these ideas. Mm-hmm. So we actually developed a formal stage and gate based new product development process. Myself and a couple others here in the building really scripted that from start to finish, looking at industry best practice, looking at what works well, and then customizing it ultimately for what will meet our own needs, contextualizing it for how we operate as a ministry and how we operate as a nonprofit. Also with the reality that for us, just because the marketers, so to speak, think that this is going to be a great idea, ultimately it's our program staff, the people who are in the field working with the kids who are going to say, you know, that mosquito net actually doesn't keep mosquitoes out. Or that mosquito net actually, you know, you gave just one to the family, but what you didn't know is that dad's a fisherman and that's a great net for catching fish. So he's going to take that.
Get repurposed.
And then that's going to get repurposed. So you end up with, you know, if you're not really lockstep with your program staff, then you can kind of go astray. So we had to develop a model for product development, which really focused on a whole lot of those variables, keeping all that into consideration.
So this was new to the organization.
Brand new.
So you put together a new product development process based on a phase gate, stage gate sort of methodology. And so it sounds like you're going through some process where you come up with ideas that are submitted. You do some product concept testing to see if they're viable or not, getting feedback from people in the field. At some point, they go into development, and then it sounds like you have a good field resources to do field testing with them and then launch them to a field.
Yeah, you're right on the money. I think the our first time out of the gate with this was about 5 years ago when we first developed the process. We knew we had a need for new ideas and everything else. And as I alluded to a second ago, you know, we knew we were never going to have a shortage of ideas.
Lots of ideas available in our organization.
My goodness, we had a 2-day retreat, did tons of ideation work, brought in great kind of third-party data for people to think about, random other ideas and even consumer products we brought in. You know, look at this. You know, how might you relate this to the field? I mean, it was all sorts of. We just got people's brains popping all over the building. It was a great exercise.
So this was a 2-day ideation retreat with employees?
Yeah, with staff. We had about 60 staff. And at the end of the 2 days, we had over 1,200 product ideas.
Wow.
So yeah, no shortage. And that, of course, was when we were very glad that we had created this larger process to funnel these ideas through and actually determine, you know, what were the products which needed to rise to the top because they were going to really do the best job of serving the needs of the kids that we have in our field countries.
So walk us through that. How many ideas did you say you started with?
About 1,200. Yeah.
Okay, what happened next?
So about 1,200 ideas, as we began to sift through, we had a team of us from our product marketing area began to sift through all 1,200 ideas. We started by just kind of letting some large bucket categories naturally form. So these are ideas that relate to health. These are ideas that might relate to education. These are ideas that might relate to disaster response and those types of things. And then as we had some larger categories, then we had to begin to even sort them into smaller categories within those. And so ultimately the process landed us after sifting through, we ended up with about 35 or so product, actual kind of fully baked product ideas. In some cases, some people obviously had written product ideas that were, you could tell they were sitting at the table and they all kind of talked about an idea and then they all kind of wrote it down, but all wrote it down kind of differently. Mm-hmm. And so we kind of merged a few that sounded similar and came up with a total of 35 that we wanted to really pursue immediately. And by pursue, I mean, put that into the opening funnel of our new product development process and begin to see what showed more fruit early on. So that's how we went about the early on phases of our process.
Okay. So we went from ideation activities, about 1,200 ideas, synthesized that, see what we related together. Out of that came about 35 well-formed product concepts. And then what happened next?
So the next phase for us was, now that we had these ideas that were generated, we then went to kind of market test. So our phase for that was we would line up along both an X and a Y axis. We had along the X axis is the questions really are, to what extent do you value the opportunity? Would you value the opportunity of supporting this concept, this product, this idea? Do you think you're effectively asking, you know, people to make a comparative analysis in their own minds? Do you think it's more important to provide safe water or HIV medicines or prevent trafficking or whatever else? I mean, it's questions that are geared toward helping us understand what people value supporting more. We know from our field staff that we had all these needs.
Right.
So that's our baseline. We knew these were needs. And so we said, okay, well, what can we tackle first? It's not that the rest of them get backburnered and never handled, but it's, you got to start somewhere. Mm-hmm. I mean, you can't solve all the world's problems immediately, right?
So it was a ranking exercise with the 35.
It was very much
basically how excited are you about this product
idea? Yeah, how excited are you about the product idea? And that went out to people through a web-based kind of quant study sent out to people who we had already kind of pre-screened as would be open to supporting an organization like ours. Christian-based organization who works through local churches in those countries to help children living in extreme poverty.
Okay.
And so,
but not existing sponsors. These were
right.
This was a new market.
Absolutely. Yeah. This is brand new folks who should be sponsors or supporters based on their profile, but we haven't found them.
Ever talked to them? Before.
Haven't talked to them necessarily yet, or they're not in the door at the moment. And so that was the first question. The second question was then, second set of questions is really set up to determine to what extent would they be likely to support it. So the first question is, how much do you value the idea of it? The next question is, well, of all these ones, which one would you be able to support? Now we're talking about, you're seeing the dollar equation come in. How much money would this be monthly? Is this a one-time gift? Is this a monthly gift? Is this an ongoing donation? Is this just a one-time need? And filling out those types of things. And so we ended up taking both of those sets of questions and then plotting them along the X and Y axes to determine, you know, when we had those products that landed in the upper right quadrant, those are the ones that we thought, okay, from an external standpoint, prospective potential future donors and future supporters, this cluster of products are the ones that they would most likely support. And of the 35, we had 10 that came into that upper right quadrant.
So 10 made the cut. Yes, I'm excited about this product. So the audience was someone that's not currently a sponsor, but has the profile of someone that would be interested in sponsoring with Compassion sponsoring. Kids donating to Compassion. And so I'm excited about the product. I would be willing to provide X dollars, whatever was in the survey. So that was your upper right quadrant.
Yes.
Okay.
Yes.
So you went from, again, 1,200 to 35. Now we're down to 10.
Now we're down to 10. That's right. And the filtering and the whittling down process continues. That the next step for us is more of an internal look. We have to look at our own internal systems, our own internal technology. And what internal mechanisms do we have in place that can support these products? There might be a product which we think is, you know, has great potential, but if we have no existing infrastructure that's anywhere near able to support it, then that's not going to be a feasible solution for us to bring to market anytime soon. So that was the ultimate goal, was to begin to sift through and identify which ones had potential, and then ultimately do some ranking based on that as well.
Was that just feasibility for the organization being able to get it done? Was it also fit to the organization? Was it, you know, should these product concepts that fit our mission?
Yeah, that's a great question. The fit question, we actually bake a little bit earlier into our process.
Okay.
So
those 35 ideas
were fit. I mean, there were some out there that we just said, you know, that's a great product idea, but that's not our brand. That's not who we are as an organization. That's not our identity. It's maybe a massive need, but it's not something that we have the expertise or would be equipped maybe to do.
There are other faith-based nonprofits that
absolutely
have interest in that. Right.
Absolutely.
Not a fit for you.
Yep. So by this point, we've got 10. We've now got them rank ordered based on internal options. And we began to move forward in our process with actually doing a little bit of deeper engagement with around some specific ideas and some specific products at this point with different focus groups. at this point, we engage more of the creative side. You know, we present the creative idea of these products to a couple of various creative agencies, get them to drop some mock-ups. How would you present this idea to people? And we had, for a couple different products, I think at that point we'd kind of said we wanted to move forward with three, I believe, at that point. And went out to creative agencies, got all that collateral, and then put that collateral and those ideas in front of focus groups to learn what they would say. These focus groups, again, not supporters, not existing supporters, but you know, people who have fit the profile of someone who has said in the past they would be supportive of an organization like Compassion.
And the collateral at that point was visuals, graphics?
Yep.
You're not doing physical mock-ups.
No.
And some of these products might not fit that, right? But it's a description of the service, maybe pictures of how that impacts recipients of the service.
That's exactly right.
Okay. I mean,
you begin with expressing the need, helping the people understand the need for this product. So if it's safe water, then what are the statistics related to how many children die from waterborne illnesses on a daily basis or on an annual basis? How does unsafe water affect the health of an entire family or an entire village? But more specifically in our world, the life of that child who is in our program, who's trying to pull out of poverty and make this new life for his or her future. And so, yeah, we're talking about creative mock-ups, photos, great descriptors, sets of keywords that we might use to describe the product as well. And we move forward to see what shakes out at that point.
Okay. So you took three to do more market research with, three concepts.
Yeah, we did. And we ended up, actually, there was two of us in the product development space at that point who really had enough room on our plate to take a product at the time and begin to kind of bolt with it and just run with it.
Mm-hmm.
So I ended up taking a water-focused product, and one of my colleagues began to take kind of an infant mortality-based product. How do we, you know, provide more nurturing care to the moms so that there's a safe birth and that type of thing? And so my realm went more into the water focus. And so I was sitting in these, observing these focus groups of people evaluating some new water technology that we had come across and thought would really solve some of the issues that our kids have been facing around the world.
Okay. So we got it narrowed down to one that you were running with now and trying to flesh out the real concept of what to do about a water product. What did you consider within the realm of possibilities? There's lots of ways to provide clean water to impoverished kids.
Yeah, well, I mean, as I alluded to earlier, our biggest hurdle here was providing safe water in the child's home.
Okay.
You can provide safe water through a well or through a borehole or through all sorts of other types of technologies and solutions. But ultimately, if the child still has to walk, let's say in the middle of the household needs water, most of the time in most households, the father's not the one in these countries that goes and gets the water.
Okay.
It's mother or it's the children. And we're not talking about sometimes a short distance of a walk. It wouldn't be uncommon for it to be a 5K round trip to get water from the nearest source. Not uncommon at all. And you're talking about children who are then carrying buckets of water, and that's heavy. So there's a whole lot of reasons why an in-home safe water solution is the most important.
Mm-hmm.
In talking with our folks in the field, what we learned pretty quickly, and I think what we all understood kind of intuitively after having a couple of conversations, was that, well, it can't be a solution that requires any power. It can't be a solution that requires batteries. It can't be a solution that has parts which need to be fixed maybe on a regular basis, or, you know, the filtering mechanism for the water might, you know, only last for 6 months at a time or something, and then have to get a new one. I mean, these things, there's no neighborhood Home Depot for them to run down and get a replacement part.
Right.
So if you're going to provide a long-term solution, it's got to be sustainable,
mm-hmm.
and it's got to last.
So this really was designing for that environment, designing for their use and their serviceability capability.
Absolutely.
Okay.
So that's kind of where we began a lot of our kind of reviews of different technologies. There's some great technology we discovered. There's some companies that do these great filter straws. It's just a mm-hmm. straw. You can get any cup of water, and the filter is the straw. But have you ever seen a three-year-old try to drink through a straw? I mean, the concept alone is, why isn't the water just coming into my mouth naturally? What do you mean I have to do something else with my mouth? I don't understand this. Plus, most children, you can't get enough pressure to actually pull the water through the filtering mechanism in some cases. So this wasn't a viable solution.
Yeah, actually, we have those for hiking. And my kids who are older, you know, 9 and 12 now, they can use them certainly, but they still talk about, why is it so hard to suck the water through this?
Sure, sure. And yeah, 9 and 10, right? So 3-year-old,
not a chance.
4-year-old, not working. Yeah, exactly. So ultimately, we came across a company that had been developing a water filtration system for camping use. And they had already some inklings and some ideas about maybe this would also work in the developing world. But they, you know, they're a camping supply company. They don't have an inroad there. And so as we began to have those conversations, we began to learn more about the technology that they had been working with and discovered that in this case, they were using a hollow fiber membrane filtering system, which is just basically a big tube, a collection of tubes that are porous enough to allow water in and out, but the pore size is 0.1 micron in size. So therefore, anything larger than 0.1 micron in size doesn't pass through.
Okay. And how small do you need to be to block pathogens?
Exactly.
In some world countries?
0.1 microns, all biological contaminants are larger than 0.1 micron.
Okay.
So we figured, well, hey, that's great. This sounds like it might be a viable solution. But now we got to figure out, well, what's the technology that you're going to use to push the water through this thing with enough pressure? And doing some research and everything else, we discovered, you know, if you fill up a 5-gallon bucket with dirty water, there's enough water pressure just with gravity flow. If you put the nozzle at the bottom of the bucket, that the water will just push its way through the filter. And so we jokingly said, well, I guess this will work everywhere that has gravity, which hopefully is everywhere on this planet at least. And so we were able pretty safe bet. So we were able to kind of put that together and develop what we called, it was basically a bucket and a filter. That's what the technology looked like. So by the time we get to these focus groups.
Easy enough to use.
Yeah.
Easy enough to service.
That's right. You know, very easy to service.
No moving parts there to break.
That's right.
No fuses to replace, no motors to have to fix.
No, and I can't actually, emphasize enough. I mean, the value and the importance of contextualizing the solution to the people who you're serving, the people who need the solution, and thinking about all of those little intricate details about contextualization is so important. I've traveled to dozens of developing countries now, and more often than not, I've seen solutions that are sitting in people's homes. Water solutions, as an example. Well, the battery ran out,
right.
Or the filtering mechanism went through. They needed to get a new one. Actually,
probably seen well pumps.
I've seen the most heartbreaking one was in Haiti, a water well that was just dripping water. There was still plenty of water sourced below. But whatever company or whoever had installed this water well, which was the primary water source for this community, it was a fuse. It required a fuse. And after a certain amount of time, the fuse blew. They do that. And they're on an island off the coast of Haiti, Loganov Island, and there is no fuse.
There's no fuse store on that.
You can't go get a fuse. I mean, that's just not going to happen.
Right.
And so they were like, okay, well, we'll go back to, you know, making the trek out to the sea.
What we did
trying
before.
To boil the water, trying to, I mean, it's a process.
Yeah.
So for us, having no replacement parts needed and something that was easy and simple to set up and use was really important. Mm-hmm. The other thing was the longevity of the filter mechanism, obviously. And because of the technology being used, the filter actually could be self-cleaning in a way. I mean, you just have some take some safe water that you put through the filter, and then using a syringe or some other way, you kind of push it back through and clean the filter. And in their early tests, they discovered they could do up to 1 million gallons of water with this thing. I mean, it's no larger than a roll of quarters, the actual filter mechanism. To do 1 million gallons, and if you do the math.
Yeah, I was wondering about that.
Yeah.
How long does this last a family?
Yeah, so a family, you know, your average person, if you drink your doctor recommended 64 ounces of water a day or 82 ounces of water a day, whatever we drink, what you're supposed to drink. If you drink all that in your entire lifetime and you live to be 80, you'll only do about 16,500 gallons of water. So a million
takes care of a family and then some.
Yeah, you're basically looking at water for about 60 people for a lifetime.
Wow.
That's
huge. And it's from a bucket and a small filter that's less than like the size of a roll of quarters.
That's right.
That you can back flush yourself.
Yeah.
And keep it working.
And the killer of this whole thing is the entire technology is actually based on kidney dialysis technology. It's technology we had around since the 70s, but someone finally said, well, if this technology can clean blood, I wonder if it could also clean water. Well, sure enough, it works. So, you know, 40 years later, reapplied old technology for a new purpose, and we've got safe water in the developing world. So,
very good.
Yeah.
Okay, so you went through this ideation to product development process. So mm-hmm. just to recap again, 1,200 ideas during a two-day ideation meeting, ideation event, narrowed that down to 35, ranked those, came up with 10, took three out to market research. You took one of those then to actually develop into a viable concept, do prototypes, do field testing. So tell us about the field testing part of this.
So the field testing part of this, we took some of those different solutions that I mentioned before, and we went out to a couple different field countries, and they tested them. We ran kind of we started with a health assessment of a group of people, gave them the water solution to use, and then did a new health assessment 6 months later to determine if it had made an impact on the health of the individuals, of the kids. And that was our major benchmark. You know, is this thing working? Is it usable? And then kind of interviewing those folks after the fact, you know, what was usable, what was not. And we had our field staff do that work. I mean, they speak the local language and they know the community very well. And they're able to, that's one of the great things about us, you know, Compassion, we only hire in, you know, locals. You're not going to send a bunch of us Westerners out there.
I mean, there aren't culture clashes.
Yeah, you don't have to worry about any of that stuff. It's just, hey, did this thing work? Did it? Yes or no? I mean, and we get good data back that way. Mm-hmm. So
and
that's
find
what
find out if it's being used the way you intended. Like the
that's right.
The net that ended up for fishing.
That's right. I mean, unfortunately, we found that the syringe that I mentioned before, which is used to push water back through and clean the filter, we did discover some folks had used that, had attached a needle, and were using it to vaccinate their cattle because they had been needing something like that. So we quickly, in later iterations of the product, it's now kind of a bulb, more of a squeezy bulb type thing, which pushes water back through, and not really a
more challenging
a syringe that you can use for multiple purposes.
And with the feedback, did you learn more about training that needed to be done to use the product properly? Were there issues with that?
Yeah, what we learned is that with the deployment of the product, there's going to need to be continued additional contextualization around the training. For example, in Rwanda, when we began to deploy this in Rwanda, we found there was a whole lot of heavy clay sediment in the dirt. And so if they weren't actually cleaning the filter system every other day or really daily, if it got dry, if the supply line of water and the filter kind of got dry in there ever, it would turn into a rock. I mean, that clay would just settle in there and the whole thing becomes unusable. Mm-hmm. And so that became part of the training mechanism in Rwanda. Now, as part of our ongoing strategy, every time we deploy this to a new country, we start with a test group and heavily monitor, understand how is it working, is it not working, what needs to be changed, those types of things, and then standardize the training for that country based on the needs.
So in product launch terms, you're localizing this for each group that it goes to.
Yeah, exactly. The
country.
Exactly, yeah.
And tailored training as needed.
Yeah. Now, the flip side of the whole thing, if you go back to the focus group model, though, once we had pictures and descriptions of this filter, you know, the focus groups got really interesting. Mm-hmm. Here we're now with groups of Americans saying, would you support this? Because we were able to price this up front at we thought would be around $50. It's now $79 mm-hmm. per unit. But at the time, we were estimating it'd be around $50 or $60.
And what is that cost? Is that the cost to make this, or is that the cost from a donor to provide one?
Yeah, so that's the cost. That's what the donor provide. That's what the donor would provide in order to be able to get the filter, the training, the entire unit manufactured, shipped from overseas, and deployed and delivered to that end user's home through the local church that he or she is connected with there in the community.
Right.
And so, pretty good deal for safe water for the rest of your life. Still, you know, $79 isn't a bad deal. But, you know, that's when you learn the power in those focus groups. You learn the power of words. You learn the power of what descriptions work well, what don't work well. And I'll never forget, we had given this entire description about this incredible product that's going to provide safe water for children around the world for $50, $60 a month. Excuse me, one time, not a month, one time.
Yeah.
For $60 one time. And at the end of the focus group, we said, how many of you here in the focus group, how many of you would want to support something like that? And we're thinking, you know, those of us marketers behind the glass, right? We're thinking we've hit this one out of the park. This is going to be great. Not one person raised their hand.
That was deflating.
that killed. And so I'm getting with the researcher and I said, I'm whispering in their ear and I said, can you, we have the little two-way, you know, the little microphone to the researcher, the focus group moderator. I just said, can you please ask why? And what we determined is this one gentleman spoke up and he said, I think you're lying to me. I think you're absolutely lying to me.
He goes, yes, it can't be that simple and that inexpensive.
Not only could it not be that simple and not that simple, but, and here's where the Western mindset kicks in. He says, I have a filter on my refrigerator. I have a filter on my water faucet. I have to replace those things every 6 months. You're telling me, and they cost about the same amount. You're telling me for that same amount of money, these people are going to get a filter that actually lasts a lifetime? I think you're lying to me. I think it's a scam to get my money. Hmm. Okay.
This is too good to be true.
Helpful. So in the next version, the next focus groups that came for the afternoon focus groups, we took the word filter out of everything. And we simply referred to it as a safe water system. This is your safe water system. Because it's too much to go down the road of saying, well, you're like my Brita filter on my faucet is taking out the slight chlorine taste or the metal taste or whatever. It's not taking out
stopping bacteria.
E. coli, right. And, you know, cholera. That's a whole different ballpark here. Mm-hmm. So we just
said, if you try to explain, it probably makes it sound even more unbelievable.
That's right. Now we're talking, and nor do you have that long when presenting the product option to someone. You can't describe it that. You don't take that much time. So we just said, you know, a safe water system. And by doing that, it removes the preconceived idea of, I know what a filter is.
Okay.
And suddenly, same description, same everything, but we just said safe water system instead of filter. Entire focus group, hands all went up around the room.
Reframe the product.
Yeah.
And huge success.
Absolutely. Yeah.
Wow. That's a good story in itself, right? The importance of framing the product properly in the words that we choose.
Absolutely. Absolutely.
Safe water system.
Yep. And it's a killer for us even in our marketing now, because we even in our own department here, when we try to write copy for it, we're thinking, I can't tell you the number of times I've said, no, we can't say filter. We can't say filter, because it's just so natural to say, oh, it's a bucket and a filter, because that is simple. But filter, yeah, it doesn't fly well sometimes.
Very good. Okay. And where does this sound like this has been fielded? It's in several countries?
It's been fielded now. We're actually at my last check, we had deployed, we were just under the 250,000 mark, or 250,000 of these units that have been deployed. And we're coming up with new uses as well. I mean, some countries are being innovative and they're discovering if they just attach the filtering mechanism to an oil drum and fill the entire oil drum up with dirty water, then the safe water that comes out, the water pressure is pretty phenomenal. So they're able to like fill up water bottles and everything else. They've got the kids lined up. Every kid's getting their water bottle for the day. And that, I mean,
right.
Lots of great stuff. So yeah, we're in South America, Asia, Africa, I think about 12 or 13 countries spread across those larger continents, those regions. So
good.
It's been going real well.
Yeah. I want to ask you more questions about the product innovation process for sure. But for listeners that are hearing this, and if they're getting interested, I know one of my charities is What Compassion Does and Water of Life. And I pay attention to other water charities because I see water is a vital thing for life, and especially in impoverished worlds. For anyone that's listening now that just wants to know more about Water of Life, go check it out. Where would they do that?
You can easily go to water.compassion.com, or the easier thing to maybe remember is just simply compassion.com/water of life.
Okay. So Water of Life. Probably if you Google Water of Life and Compassion.
If you Google Water of Life and Compassion, you'll see lots of things. Actually, if you Google Water of Life and Compassion through YouTube, and put those things in, you'll find a whole lot of real fun videos. We've had a lot of folks around the country that have come up with some pretty innovative story ideas or innovative ways of testing this type of system in their own backyard kind of thing.
Oh, fun.
So that's kind of fun, too.
Yeah. Cool. Okay. So back to the new product development process. So this sounds like it was a great success for the organization. Before this process went in place, this phase gate sort of process, Fashion was not really familiar with product development, with innovation, being an old organization and not doing new product development. How has this worked out for you? So this basically was an ideation approach, and there's lots of ways that we can go about getting ideas. This was an employee-based ideation approach, which I think works really well, especially for organizations that don't have much new product development process at all. Have you done another ideation event? Has this carried on?
Yeah, so the full-scale ideation event, we have not done another one of those. The model has become what we discovered is that while that generated a whole lot of buzz and a whole lot of ideas, that was great. What it did not do was provide an ongoing mechanism, create an ongoing mechanism that kind of crafted ideation and innovation as a core competency of what we do on a regular basis. Mm-hmm. So it didn't create a way for people to say, you know, gosh, you know, I was reading this magazine and I saw this idea and I got this idea. Hey, what, you know, what can I, you know, let me share that. Do I have to wait for the next innovation summit to share my idea? And, you know, what if it's not in one of the categories and everything else? So we actually created a kind of a two-step model that we use now. One is at the start of each kind of calendar year, fiscal year for us, we'll work closely with our field staff to determine, you know, what are the top needs that are out there? What are the strategic needs that we have? Then we'll start our innovation at that point. So they're innovating against a specific strategic need. Very similar to what we did before, but now it's an annual thing. And the field staff has even begun to understand, okay, at about a certain time of year, I'm going to be able to raise up, hey, we're having this strategic issue. We're really seeing this problem, and toss that need into the mix. And then we kind of open it up. In some cases, we're opening some ideas up just to the marketing teams. In some cases, we'll meet with our program staff here in the building and say, what are some ideas you have on how to solve these problems? And it really becomes more of an interactive and an ongoing conversation that allows us to involve more people in the process, but in a strategic way. Because the downside of open innovation, when you're talking about just tossing ideas kind of into a black box, is a lot of times people don't know where those ideas go to.
Exactly.
They get, oh, I have this phenomenal idea. They toss it into the box and then nothing happens and no one gives them feedback as to why. And so they get frustrated. And they think, well, the organization doesn't want my ideas. After you do that enough times and you think, well, no one's really listening. So this
can actually create more problems than...
That's absolutely right. You really can. And so, you know, we created a model that actually allows for the ongoing dialogue, the back and forth, mm-hmm. and helps people to understand that all of our solutions, all the products we come out with, are strategically targeted specifically to the type of organization we are and the kids we serve around the world.
Okay, very good. So if there was an organization that was like maybe Compassion was a decade ago that had little experience with new product development, nonprofit, not nonprofit, what would you tell an organization like that that recognized our future survivability depends on developing new products, what would you tell them to get started?
I think the first thing to do is to develop a process, develop a mechanism for evaluating products along a consistent set of variables. Mm-hmm. That was one of the keys when, as we developed our process, each stage in our process has a specific set of questions that need to be answered before the product can go on to the next stage. And this, because we scripted all those variables in advance, we knew, okay, in order for a product to get from feasibility into design, into the design phase, it needs to reach X, Y, and Z criteria. And we worked with our senior leadership to make sure that everyone's on board with what these criteria are. Mm-hmm. That way there's no surprises. It also, what that does is it does two things. It helps eliminate pet projects, because we always see, you know, somebody somewhere's got this great idea and they're going to push this through come hell or high water type of thing.
Most organizations do.
Right. And so, but no, every product has, this is our set criteria. This is the litmus test. Every product, I don't care if it comes from the CEO or if it comes from one of our supporters who lives, you know, 50 miles away. It doesn't matter who the idea comes from. They all go through the same rigor.
Okay.
So develop that process first.
Can you share any examples of those metrics? I know they changed probably by Gates, but any key ones stand out?
Yeah, so early on for us, some of those key metrics obviously involve the longevity of a product. So is this a great idea for now? Or is this an idea that we think is going to have some staying power? You know, we don't want to develop a product and get it out to market. And we're not the type of organization that will put something out to market for 6 months and then pull it and never offer it again. That takes away from the larger needs that we have in our world. You know, we have to be pretty strategic about the use of our funds. I think all organizations do, all companies do. But especially in the nonprofit world, our primary role here is stewarding the resources that God has provided. And if we're trying to listen actively to where He is asking us to do more, then we need to be strategic about the use of His funds to do more. And so those new products are ways that we do more for His kingdom. But ultimately, it's a matter of being good stewards. And so some of those early on metrics really focus around the stewardship of realizing it's a classic dilemma in product development, right? At some point along the line, you're going to kill off products which would have been successful, but they wouldn't be as successful as another product. And when you have a finite amount of resources, you have to direct it to the thing that's going to be more successful.
Yeah, like I've told groups before, you may say you have four products that are 9 or 10s. If you only have resources to do two, you're going to pick the 2 10s.
You're going to pick the 10s, that's right.
Yeah. And that's just the tough decisions you have to make. But you end up doing more good. Mm-hmm. However you're evaluating good, you end up doing more good by working on the ones that are most valuable.
Yeah. And we do some work early on within our focus groups and within our market research to understand the size of the market, mm-hmm. Potential market size, potential market penetration rates, as well as understanding, you know, what would be the cost of going out to market. And that obviously early on factors in. Those are some of those kind of static filters early on mm-hmm. for that that's part of the litmus test for every new product. It's got to meet certain criteria that the organization has said. It's got to at least be able to do X. If it can't at least do X, then it's killed. It's off the table.
Right. Good. So if you're an organization new to this, look at a product development process, how you get ideas, mm-hmm. how you evaluate those ideas, mm-hmm. how you move them through gates, making decisions.
Yep. And I can't emphasize enough, so critical to have the process in place first. Because so often you start with the idea of innovation. People say, oh, we're going to gather a bunch of new ideas. Fantastic. You have a bunch of new ideas, and then now what? And then now you have to develop a process. You have to figure out what to do with it. And that takes time. So if you start by developing the process and then gather the ideas, then you can maintain employee, staff, organizational excitement because they're going to see these products working their way through the process. Mm-hmm. That was the other thing we did. We took all these ideas. We told them we have 1,200. Now we whittled it down to 35. I mean, everybody who participated, who gave an idea, there was an ongoing report back to those folks letting everybody know what the ideas were, how they were flowing through the process. And we maintained a high level of energy. People mm-hmm. were excited to see what's going to come out the back end. What's going to be the thing that makes it, you know?
Right.
It's almost like those weird races at the baseball game on the Jumbotron. Is it going to be the hot dog? Is it going to be the fries? You know, who's going to win the race here? People were kind of getting excited to see what was going to make it to the end.
And you created a trust.
Yeah.
And excitement prior to doing this process again.
That's right.
Right.
That's right.
Yeah. Very good. You mentioned in the beginning of our discussion that you did the new product development professional certification with PDMA.
Mm-hmm.
Was that, I don't know if that was part of what was going on here. Did that help build any kind of foundation? Does that factor into?
Absolutely. It actually was a pretty big factor. Since the organization had no capacity, no history around product development, we really did a deep dive. Myself and one of my other colleagues who were really kind of put in charge of this product development process and new products, we did a deep dive and tried to learn everything we could. And so we quickly discovered the Product Development Management Association, PDMA, and their wealth of resources and knowledge base around new product and process and everything else. And then as we were discovering, well, how do we learn more? We realized that there's this certification process to become a new product development professional. And so we went for our NPDP certification, which took a whole bunch of classes over the course of, I think, about 3 months or so of coursework, and then finally a certification class, and got certified. So, and I learned a ton about what works, what doesn't work. And it was helpful because you can go through that process and sidestep a lot of the mistakes that other companies have made, or that the industry would wave their flag and say, seriously, don't ever do X, Y, or Z, you know? Okay.
Learn.
It sounded like a good idea, but maybe there's a reason we shouldn't go there. So let's not do that. Yeah.
And I didn't mean for that to sound like a self-serving question, since I provide new product development professional training.
Sure.
But I didn't know if it was a real foundation for what you guys
do. No, it absolutely was. In fact, as we continue to move forward and hire more staff in those areas, you know, NPDP certification is one of the things that we list as a desirable thing for someone coming into that role.
Good. Well, if you have anyone else that needs help getting trained, let me know.
Absolutely will.
And I always like to ask for an innovation quote. What's a quote that has meaning to you?
Innovation quote. I think for me, the quote that we put around our kind of our area of the building during this whole process and developing our model and everything else, we don't have to look much further than scripture. And there's a verse from Isaiah chapter 43, where God's saying, forget the former things, do not dwell on the past. See, I am doing a new thing. Now it springs up. Do you not perceive it? I'm making a way in the wilderness and streams in the wasteland. And for us, I mean, that's the nature of the God we serve. I mean, he's always up to something new. He's got a constant, consistent message all throughout history of redeeming his creation and all the brokenness that exists all around the world in the forms of unclean water, in forms of child slavery, and in terms of deep, deep poverty. And it's all part of the same continuum. We're a part of that same journey of trying to help as Christians, as followers of that same God, that loving God, to be his hands and feet and to do those new things, to pay attention to what he's doing, to try to accomplish the goals that God has for his creation and for his people. So, yeah, I love it. And especially the idea of forget the former things. It's Isaiah chapter 43, verse 18 and 19. Forget the former things. Do not dwell in the past.
And sound like create something new.
Yeah.
So this is the first time I've received a Bible verse as a innovation quote. But I can see innovation in there because I think of innovation as doing something in a new way.
Yeah.
And that does talk about doing something in a new way.
Well, and that's the story of, I mean, it may be slightly tangential, but that's God's story throughout history. I mean, if you look at the entire Bible, if you were to survey the entire Bible and you begin at Genesis chapter 2, and you, once the fall happens, once this separation, so to speak, then throughout the rest of it, it is covenant after covenant after covenant. It is God saying, okay, Noah, I got this thing. You're going to help me redeem the world. Abraham, you're going to help me redeem the world. David, I got this promise. I got his history throughout all of history. His track record is continuing to try to put us back together again. And finally, with sending his son, Jesus, to die for our sins and to offer up that salvation for all of us, and then passing the gauntlet to us as the individuals, as the followers, to say, now keep the ball rolling. It's a continuum. And this new way, this new thing, God's always doing something new, but it's always around the same idea. And as God's always doing something new for that same idea of restoring humanity, then us as a Christ-centered organization need to be in touch with what he's doing new and offer ways for people who are part of this Christian community or the larger world overall, ways for people to engage with what God is doing through our productization of different opportunities or in many other ways. So it's all part of the same story for me.
And that connects back to the passion of why you work here and others work here.
That's right.
And which we see in most nonprofits, I would expect, right? The people work there because they're passionate about the mission and the message.
Absolutely.
I haven't read the Bible before looking for innovation insights, but maybe I'll have to start now.
There you go.
Jeff, I really appreciate your time. Thank you for talking about the ideation approach and that new product development approach that you've used here and sharing an example of Water of Life.
Yeah, thanks for your time, Jeff.
Thank you for listening to Product Innovation Training Your Customers Will Love You For. To learn more, please check out the blog at theeverydayinnovator.com. Keep innovating.